session number 30304.
Ted Rayner, reel 12.
Yes. To give you some idea of what you could get out of a Hudson, when we were in Iceland, there was an American Lightning squadron there, flying from a different airfield, but we sometimes came across them in the sky. We were doing an air test off, and they were fiddling around, and didn't seem to fly very far away anyway. They were they were twin bodied as well as being twin engine, and for twin engine fighter they were quite manoeuvrable. But we'd have a bit of fun sometimes, just mixing it. If you came across a Lightning, you know, and you sort of nodded to him, and he'd give you the thumbs up and so on. So, oh, here's a buddy here. And get on his tail sort of thing, you know, and he'd soon be off his, get out of your way and come on your tail before you knew. And we used to, you know, have a bit of fun like that. And really, it was surprising what you could do in those circumstances. So they were, I loved the Hudson and everything.
You mentioned earlier that you were not happy, though, with the undercarriage. Was there a problem with the undercarriage?
As far as I was concerned, yes. I can tell you about a couple of accidents, if you like. I still hold myself as partially blameless over them, so I don't have any feeling of guilt about it. At Silloth, as I think I mentioned, we went to a grass field. In other words, we could still take off and land into wind. because of the usual pressure at that time, 1940, to get people through and onto squadrons, and to bring airfields up to the standard which they needed for the aircraft then available, runways became essential. Of course, with our climate and with heavier aircraft, you soon get bogged down if you were trying to take off and land into wind. And they decided that the work on the runways at Silloth would go on 24 hours a day, through the night as well. And when a chap called Sergeant Mitchell and I were programmed to do our night flying, we decided, we took turns, we decided we'd do two circuits and bumps each and then change one to the other without going into without going into change anyway. I don't know why, probably tossed up a coin. I was first to go. The floodlights that were necessary for this work to go on during the night were not screened in any way, and they were rather blinding as one came in on the final approach. And the flare path, of course, had been laid out in what was as close a line to the line of the wind as possible under the circumstances. And so as we came in on the final approach, obviously I needed to point the aircraft at the runway. But I noticed that the... I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that we had glim lamps, not the... not the flares that we had at Little Rissington. So there was no indication from smoke as to the wind direction. The glim lamps were just tall, well, just lamps which were as, they were as good as the flares, but they didn't have any smoke coming from them. So I obviously pointed the aircraft as we were going down at this line of flares, but I noticed that I was drifting. I had to keep turning slightly to keep the point that the nose pointed down the runway, and I was drifting further off until eventually, just as I was putting the aircraft down on the deck, I was not pointing down the runway, so that when the wheels touched, rather than going in the direction they should have done down the runway, they were being the inertia of the aircraft wasn't in the, going in the same direction as the wheels, so there was a lot of sideways pressure on the wheel undercarriage, and it collapsed amidst the creaking metal. We slithered along the runway. Of course, I closed the throttle and switched off, and we came to a halt eventually. And it didn't take very far for it to come to a halt either. And both Mitchell and I got down as quickly as we could onto terra firma, and that was that. Strangely enough, that meant, well, not strangely enough because it was obvious, that meant that the night flying detail was cancelled for that particular evening, but it was, strangely enough, that the same programme was put out the next night, and the circumstances were much the same. There had been a fair amount of, as on the previous day, there had been a fair amount of wind during the day, which was more or less in line with the flare path, but the wind calmed at dusk, and we had very little indication of the true direction of the wind. We just knew approximately that it was where the flare path had been put. The same thing happened coming in on the approach. The nose started to vary from the path it should have been taking in correlation with the flare path, and the difference was that I suddenly realized the fact that such a simple explanation of what was happening, the line of the flare path was the track that I should have been flying, and the position, relative position of the aircraft, the line that the aircraft was going, should have been the course I was steering, and that it was just too late. I tried to make the necessary correction, but we were down, and the same thing happened. this time, we both got out as quickly as we could, which is just as well, because we stepped into a pool of petrol. The wing tanks had ruptured. The thing that struck me about it was that I just hope that whoever is teaching pilots going to other units, and particularly those involved in a lot of night flying, are told that in a crosswind landing you've got to allow for drift. And as a result of what had happened, the squadron commander decided that there could be no further night flying there until the runways had been completed.
Was there an investigation into the accidents that occurred to you? Were you
no, not as such. Which, of course, led me to think that the blame for the accident wasn't entirely mine. I got a reprimand from the CO, but I think he recognised that although he may have been instructed to get the runways, well, to do everything possible to facilitate the making of the runways, that this was an extraordinary incident, that the arc lights were in themselves too great a distraction, because it was very difficult to pick up the flare path, trying to avoid the light from the arc lights, and he wrote in my logbook, this pilot damaged aircraft on two occasions when carrying out night flying, and needs considerably more experience before carrying out further night flying. That was all. There was nothing said. I think most people, and certainly my instructor, realized that there had been many faults along the line. And most obviously, I just hope that somewhere a realization had been made that this was a difference that needed to be emphasized greatly, as between always being able to fly into wind and coming down in a crosswind. I don't know if you saw on television this storm in some place or other where this aircraft was trying to come in, and he was obviously suffering not only a crosswind but a buffeting crosswind of 100 and something miles an hour. From what I saw, I may have been rather cruel about it, but it seemed to me that I'll put it as carefully as I can, in that the attitude of the aircraft could suggest either that he had correctly allowed for drift and then found that he had to make a correction because he didn't take it off in time, and at the same time a gust of wind took his left wing up, which it should have been level and going across the runway so that he could then turn to get the wheels going down the runway, just instead of taking off to go around again. And it was a perfect example. He was a very unfortunate pilot, and I'm not being critical, it's just that sort of attitude was one which leads to all kinds of problems.
Was the problem with the undercarriage as well that it could, on collapse, and it could rupture the fuel?
Well, that's what used to happen, yeah. That was one, the great problem with the Hudson. It did burn very, very easily.
And was that usually from an undercarriage collapse or something like that in the wings?
Yeah.
What was the kind of pattern of training that you continued on with? What were the other types of things that you were doing?
We had a... obviously, low flying, and of course, shoal wave earth was ideal for that. No particular bombing range to attack, but we were sent out to find something that we could use as in simulation of a target to attack at low level. I think the squadron can claim to be one of the originators of bouncing bombs, in that at that time, I'm speaking now of the squadron, not so much of the OTU, but the squadron that I would be joining, 220. At that time, a low-level attack was the chosen attack, a type of attack, where possible, so that you would heave the aircraft, pulling back on the stick, of course, and adjusting your power accordingly, heave over the ship, presumably whatever was on the surface, and then down again on the other side, taking immediate maneuvering action. But the important thing was to drop the bomb so that it didn't necessarily bounce, but reached the target, the side of a ship, at water level or just below, because that was the most damaging part to damage a ship with the greatest impact and consequences. So that was part of the that particular kind of training. We didn't do any high-level bombing because it hadn't been thought about as being necessary at that point.
What is the sensation of low-level flight? I say it's different from flying at sort of normal altitudes or high level.
Well, the most important thing is to... particularly if you've got someone on your tail, obviously, is to get as low as you can, but remembering that you're not going to go, it's unlikely that you'll be allowed to go in a straight line. And although you may be clear of the surface of the sea, let's say at 50 feet or lower, I mean 30 feet is reasonable, in manoeuvring, the wing, if you're turning left, it would be the left wing, is lower, much lower, than the underside of the aircraft, and the wing is probably what, as much as 10, 15 feet lower than the aircraft in the turn. I mean, the rest of the aircraft in the turn, and also if you are being attacked, you're concentrating on two things, more than two, but two important things: someone who is wanting to get on your tail, and the flying of the aircraft. Because it's more than likely that in a steep turn, on this case to the left, you're going to lose a bit of height unless you're very, very careful. You may have to put on a bit of bottom rudder or something of that kind, and increase your engine speed on the side into which you're turning, as well as on the other. In other words, don't use them together, but use one to try and help you bring or keep up the wing, so that that's the kind of thing that, because we knew we were going to a squadron where this was a typical kind of attack, we concentrated on. Added to which, at that time, there were no real facilities for our use. There were facilities for other. I think the Fleet Air Arm had something locally, at least not, you know, within reach. But we didn't do any bombing runs at a height of more than 4,000 feet.
So, Ted, where did you practice the low flying?
Well, of course, we had the whole of the Solway Firth for that purpose. And as you probably know, the Solway Firth extends down into the Irish Sea, and we can quite easily get to well-known targets for that kind of thing, from Southport Pier to the piers at Blackpool, St Anne's, and then further along. So on one occasion we were able to practice our low flying going down the Solway Firth, and then when we reached Southport Turn onto the target, that was Southport Pier and the end of it, where there seemed to be a band playing in the at the end of the pier. And we went round again, saw people waving, and after jumping Southport Pier, imagining, of course, that it was the side of a ship, and we had to get a bomb in what would be the superstructure of the pier, had we actually been doing it for real, we then carried on across, and it was a bit of a problem, and having known Blackpool before the war, and knowing that the distance between the South Pier and the Central Pier is greater than the distance between the Central Pier and the North Pier, going over the South Pier was relatively easy, and of course pulling up to go over the Central Pier, but then it was very, very tight. Didn't really get down as low as we would have liked to, before leaving a bit of room to get over the top of the North Pier. And so we went along, and there were people who seemed to be quite happy, thinking that, I think there'd been probably one of the appeals for keep the RAF flying or that kind of thing. Invest in national, say, war bonds or some similar advertisement, and certainly it seemed to give us a good wave here and there. And so then we went round by Fleetwood and across to Range Rover Sands, by which time Henry, my co-pilot, thought it was time that he had a go, so we swapped. And he carried on round Whitehaven and round the corner, past St Beast Head, and then back down into the Solway Firth and back to Silloth as though nothing untoward had happened.
At that time, because I know that the Solway Firth or that round that area got the nickname of Hudson Bay later in the war, was that a nickname that you used, or was that something that happened later?
No, it was. It had already earned that name, I think. Largely, well, the actual area was called Skinburness, and there was a little bay there just beyond the intervening land, perhaps 4 or 5 miles north of Silloth, across the water there. And the reason there were many Hudsons dumped there was because if engines failed with an inexperienced pilot, there wasn't much else you could do, and it was much more inviting to try and do a ditch landing in a bit of water than it would have been to losing control of the aircraft, than it would have been to make an attempt when any alternative attempt wasn't feasible. And of course, at that time, the OTU hadn't been open or very long, and I think after the first one that went in there, it probably became known as the Hudson Bay. And then when it expanded, before I returned as an instructor, there had been quite a few more additional Hudsons had gone in, so obviously it had this sobriquet for forever, I suppose.
And where were you accommodated?
We were billeted in what was called the Hydro Hotel. I think, had a certain elegance perhaps about it at one time, but certainly whether we were bringing down its reputation or not, I don't know. But there were signs that made it less than pleasant, such as, dare I say it, I don't suppose the owner at the time is still alive or worried about it, but there was a little trouble from cockroaches and so on. But it was quite nice to have a group of people who, of course, became very good friends going to be posted. We didn't know at the time that they were going to be posted to Thornaby, to 608 Squadron, where we shared the airfield with them.
Is it a good thing to be all billeted together in that environment? Does that help kind of foster a morale?
Yes. Yes, this was most noticeable later, actually. Although we had a good spirit on 220 Squadron when operating from Thornaby, comes later, of course, chronologically. But as you mentioned, it is a fact that it was very noticeable that when we were stationed at Thornaby, there were so many outside interests and entertainments. Middlesbrough, Thornaby, Stockton-on-Tees, all within easy distance, walking distance, in fact. I mean, we would go to a dance in Middlesbrough and just walk the girl home and then walk back to the station. Although, as I say, we had a good morale, when we were moved up to Wick, and there weren't the same facilities there up in the north, extreme northeast of Scotland, it did become apparent that we were more closely knit, having constant contact with each other and immediately knowing what is happening in our personal lives.